was arrested. As you recall, at first for his own safety and his own protection. But then he's being held for question, as you remember. In the 22nd chapter, he asked for permission to speak for himself. He called it his defense, and that he gave. In chapter 23, where we are in our study tonight, he is taken before the Sanhedrin, and then he is delivered before Felix, the governor. What happens in chapter 23? Well, there are four themes that develop in this chapter. We have Paul standing before the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin was the highest court among the Jews. It was the supreme court among the Jews. The Romans, of course, were in power and had ultimate authority. But among the Jews, this was their highest court. And Paul is now carried before the highest court among the Jews. It is supposed to be a trial, but it doesn't last very long. And it is not much of a trial. Paul disrupts it and dismisses it before they're ready for it to be dismissed. And then we have in verse 11, where the Lord the next night appeared unto Paul and assures him that things are going to be such that he will be spared and that he will go to Rome, not under the conditions in which he thought. 12 to 22, we see a plot that there was to ambush Paul in his mockery of a journey of his going back before the Sanhedrin. And then Paul is finally delivered to Caesarea. So here's what happens. In this matter of going before the Sanhedrin, Paul said he had lived in all good conscience before God, and to this day, he said. He started on that note. And Ananias commanded that Paul be struck in the mouth, and we'll talk about why he did that in a moment. He didn't like what Paul had just said. He was very offended by that. And then in verses 6 through 10, Paul stated that he was condemned because of the hope of the resurrection, and that disrupted that, and that's as far as this trial got. And then it was the next night that he was assured that he was going to go to Rome and his life would be spared. Now, there were 40-plus Jews who had made the plot and made the vow and taken an oath that they were going to kill Paul. The plan is told here in the text that we'll get to in a few moments. Paul's nephew heard about the plot, and he spoiled the plot by going and telling Paul, and Paul had him then taken before the commander, taken to Claudius Lysias, and therefore it is spoiled. And then Paul's delivered to Caesarea, that is, the commander prepared the protection, and quite a protection he gave to carry Paul to Felix, and he sent a letter along, and that letter is most interesting about the character of this man named Lysias. And then Paul is delivered to Felix. And so there is some history here, but there are some things that we learn. I want you to notice, though, at verse 18. Let's get ahead of ourselves to verse 18. And that is, the text says there that, so he took him and brought him to the commander and said, this was what the centurion said, who was in charge of Paul while he's in prison, Paul the prisoner called me to him and asked me to bring this young man to him. That's his nephew he's talking about. And he has something to say to you. And I look at this verse to suggest to you that he describes Paul as Paul the prisoner. He is a prisoner at this point, and he will be to the end of the book. He will not be released from this imprisonment during this study of the book of Acts. So let's talk about Paul the prisoner, because that is what he is called here, and see some things about Paul the prisoner in Acts chapter 23. What I see reflected in Acts chapter 23 is Paul's character. I see his struggles that he had, how he was treated, and the character of those who were holding him and those who were putting him before trial. Let's focus first on his conscience. Verse 1. At verse 1, Paul addresses the Sanhedrin, and he says in verse 1 that he looked earnestly at them and he said, I have lived in all good conscience before God unto this day. Let's define the conscience. It is that faculty of mind that prompts us to do what we believe to be right and refrains us from doing what we believe to be wrong. Every one of us have a conscience. You have a conscience. Paul had one, and so did they have a conscience. That is, the Sanhedrin and Lysias and all the others. It is that faculty of mind that guides you to prompt you to do what you believe to be right and refrains you from doing what you believe to be wrong. Now, the point that Paul is making is that he had lived in all good conscience before God unto this day. But let's go further and define this conscience. A.T. Robertson said in his comments at Acts 23:1 that the word conscience means literally joint knowledge. It means to know together. Con, the prefix, means together with, and science you recognize as being knowledge. And so it means together with knowledge. The idea is the knowledge of what you should do, or what you think you should do, with what you do. That's your conscience. That's what conscience is all about. Now let's talk about the point that Paul is making. What Paul is saying before the Sanhedrin, and here is his point. We often quote the verse in the context of saying, we need to look at a man who was conscientious and yet he was wrong. And we're going to make that point again in just a moment, as we often do. But what was his point here to the Sanhedrin? His point to the Sanhedrin was, I have always been sincere and I've always done what I thought to be right. They didn't like that, of course. Acts chapter 24, verse 16. We'll not take the time to turn there, but if you want to cross-reference, in Acts 26, he makes the point again in the next chapter as he goes before Felix, and then when he goes before Agrippa, he tells him the same thing. I've always done what I thought to be right, and I am sincere, and I was sincere when I was a Jew. I am a sincere person now that I am a New Testament Christian. That is his point. But let's talk about various states of one's conscience. It is possible to have a good or a pure conscience. In 1 Timothy 3 and in verse 9, Paul talks to Timothy about a clean and a pure conscience. Let's turn there just for a moment to see that he tells Timothy that it is possible to have one. Speaking of deacons here, that they are holding the mystery of faith with a pure conscience. That's the kind of men that ought to be appointed as deacons. In 1 Peter 3 and in verse 21, the baptism is the answer of a good conscience toward God. The answer is the word for inquiry. It is inquiring of God that I might have a clear conscience. The reason you were baptized was you're seeking to have a clear and clean conscience. And it's possible to have a good conscience or a clean conscience. It's also possible to have a weak conscience. That's not a problem to have. It's not that you need to make it stronger, it is weak, but it has to do with one who cannot conscientiously do some things that may be right to do. And this was in the case of eating of meats that was sacrificed to idols. There's nothing wrong with that. But there were some who had a conscience problem with that, and therefore their conscience was said to be weak, 1 Corinthians 8 and in verse 12. It is possible to have an evil conscience, Hebrews 10 and in verse 22. That is a conscience of that evil person who is set to do what's wrong, and he doesn't really seem to have much of what we would label as a conscience of doing what's right, but it is an evil conscience, it is described as being. And one reason that that may be true is it's possible to sear your conscience. Here are some who have their conscience seared as with a hot iron. It is the idea their conscience had this pricking ability to tell them, this is wrong, don't do that. But they continue to say to themselves that it's okay to do that. And they continue to do that until they're not bothered with that anymore and their conscience is now seared. If you really wanted to be a thief and you wanted to steal, you could convince yourself that stealing is okay and you keep doing that till it doesn't bother you to steal anymore. So that when you get caught and, yeah, I stole and I am stealing and I don't care that I'm stealing because it doesn't bother me to do that anymore. It is possible to have your conscience seared, the text tells me. Now, what I learned from this text is that a clear conscience can be wrong. Paul's was, and he makes that point here. That even when he was in the Jewish religion and persecuting Christians and voicing his opinion that they should be put to death, he had said that in the previous chapter in his defense, that he indeed was wrong in that regard. And thus I learned from that this very important principle. I learned that sincerity is not enough to be saved, as many of our religious friends so think. And I also learned from that it's possible to do wrong and not be bothered by that. That there are people all over the world that are doing things that are wrong and they're not bothered by the wrong. It may be lying. I've known of Christians who outright lie, but they're not bothered by that anymore. So it is altogether possible that I could be doing wrong and at the same time, my conscience doesn't bother me in that. I see that in the case of Saul and the Apostle Paul. Let's talk about a good conscience. Just for a moment, a good conscience is essential. Whatsoever is not of faith is sin. Faith in this context, in Romans 14, as you well know, is not talking about faith of the sense of the revealed faith, that is the faith. It is not talking about my personal faith in the sense that I have my acknowledgement of God and that I grow in that faith. It has to do with your opinion or your scruples as per verse 1. And here is one whose conscience will not allow them to do certain things. And the point is, do not ever violate your conscience, even when your conscience may be telling you certain things are wrong that are not wrong. For example, if your conscience says, I cannot eat meats, then don't eat meats. It would be wrong for you to eat meats. It would be absolutely wrong. And there are Christians who think their conscience would not allow them, for example, to do something like playing cards because they associate that with gambling. Okay, if that is your conscience, then it would be wrong for you to play cards. So you cannot violate your conscience and be right. I learned that from this text in Romans chapter 14. But that does not suggest in any way that let your conscience just be your guide. The concept of letting your conscience be your guide is that as long as you feel okay, then just do that. And as long as you think everything's all right, then you're okay. But he's not suggesting let your conscience be your guide. But what I learned from Romans 2 and in verse 15, if you might turn there with me, is that the conscience must be guided by the Word. This is talking about the Gentile world. And the Gentile world, which had not been given the law of Moses, were adapting to the principles that they had learned from the Jews. And the text says, who showed the work of the law written in their hearts. Their conscience also bearing them witness. Their conscience was guided and educated by what they had learned from the law, even though they were Gentiles. And the point I'm suggesting and what the text is saying is that their conscience was educated by the Word, and that's what guided them. They were not under that law, but they were guided by the things that they had learned from the law that was so put into their conscience. So I must conclude that a conscience is only good as the knowledge that we have. And so if I have a weak knowledge of the Word, then my conscience is not all that great. But if I have a good knowledge of the Word, then my conscience is going to be much greater. Well, our conscience is not to be our sole guide. I understand that. I am guided by my conscience, and so therefore I need to make sure my conscience is educated by the Word. And so as we talk about Paul the prisoner, one of the things I learned is about conscience. Here's the second thing I learned about Paul the prisoner, and that is his courage. Beginning at verse 2 through verse 5, I say a great deal about Paul's courage. He was very courageous. And if he has not mustered courage by this point, he does at this point, at least by the time he reaches the Sanhedrin. Where do you see his courage? Number one, I see that it took courage for him to make the bold claim of innocence before the council. And you say, well, I don't see that. Oh, it did take courage too. You bet it took courage. You see, to the believer, all of us, and any believer of Paul's day, that was not a strange statement. In fact, that's a very honorable statement for him to say, I've lived in all good conscience before God unto this day. I've always done what I thought to be right. But even when I was wrong, I was doing what I thought to be right. That is such an honorable statement. But to the council, that was an absolute insult to this august body who viewed him as a heretic of the worst sort. Evidence? Well, Ananias, the high priest, commanded him to be struck, that he might silence him for so speaking improperly. You're not going to talk that way before this council, making such a claim of innocence. What an insult to us. And he commands him to be struck across the mouth. Well, what was that intended to do? To put him to silence. That took courage. That took courage to say that. Here's the second. It took courage to point out hypocrisy. Look at verse 3 of our text. Then Paul said, God will strike you, you whitewash wall, for you set judge according to the law, and you commanded me to be struck contrary to the law. That took courage. You see, such treatment of Paul was contrary to the law. Leviticus chapter 19, 15 and verse 35 essentially say the same thing, at least at the beginning of the verses. And what they were doing to Paul, the striking of Paul, was contrary to the law. Not to suggest anything about the violating of the law and charging him without any evidence. And what Paul is pointing out is, yet they are trying to judge Paul according to the law. So here comes the council together, and they're saying in essence to Paul, we want to make sure you've not violated the law. And if you have violated the law in any fashion, we're going to punish you. And then they take the law and just violate it completely in their treatment of him. And you know what Paul says? Paul says, you're hypocrites for that. That's what he means by you whitewashed wall. It had a reference to what they did for tombs. The tomb that was corrupted on the inside, they whitewashed it on the outside to make it look pleasant. So when visitors came into the city of Jerusalem, they thought everything looked fine. But these are full of dead men's bones inside. And Paul said, you're a hypocrite, is what you are. That took courage to do that. Well, at verse 4, Paul was rebuked for having spoken such to the high priest. And they said to him, those who stood by said, do you revile God's high priest? Well, it was a violation of the law. Exodus 22 and verse 28, to speak so disrespectful to the God's ruler. Some try to say that Paul did not do anything wrong here. Give their various explanations of that, but Paul was wrong. He said so. And we'll talk about that here in a second. Paul had rebuked the high priest, but he said, I didn't know that's who he was. And we'll give evidence of why that may be the case in just a moment. So I want to suggest to you, thirdly, here's another case of courage. It took courage to make this bold claim of innocence before the council, which was such an insult to them. And it took a bold case of courage to point out you are nothing but hypocrites, you especially, who said, strike him. But it took courage to admit that he was wrong. Look at verse 5. He said, I did not know, brethren, that he was a high priest, for it is written, you should not speak evil of the ruler of your people. That's Exodus 22 and in verse 18. So what's his point? Well, he said he didn't know he was high priest. He said, I didn't know that he was high priest. Now, it may be that he didn't see who had spoken to him. There's several explanations. And so students often wonder, why in the world Paul didn't know this was a high priest? He was a Jew. He should have known. Well, it's altogether possible that he didn't see who had spoken to him. He heard someone he speak say, strike him in the mouth. He might not have known that was a high priest that had spoken. Or it may be that he didn't know who was the high priest because, you see, he had been a stranger to this religion for 25 years. Suppose somebody was a member of this church and they move away and they depart from the faith and they're not even associated with brethren for 25 years and they come back and visit this church. You think they're going to know who the elders are? I doubt it. I doubt they're going to have any clue of that. Paul had been a stranger to them for 25 years. It may be that he didn't recognize him because this has been a hurried council meeting and they hurried him to this council meeting without perhaps the high priest having his garment upon. And so maybe he didn't recognize him as being the high priest. There are a number of explanations why he might not have recognized him as being the high priest. Might not have seen him, might not have known who had spoken, he might not know who was the high priest, or he might not have been in his garb as being the high priest. But the point is, he was still wrong. And Paul said that I didn't know he's a high priest, and then he quotes the passage himself. Rather than them telling him, you're wrong because you violated Exodus 22, he says, here's where I'm wrong, because I violated Exodus 22. That took courage to say, I'm wrong. Paul the prisoner was a courageous man. Here's the third thing, beginning at verse 6. In the story of Paul, I see a story not only of conscience and courage, but conflict. There were two points of conflict in verses 6 to 10, and here's the first. The first point of conflict was a real conflict with Paul centered around the resurrection. Look at verse 6. Paul perceived that one part of the Sadducees and the other part Pharisees. He cried to the council, men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. Concerning the hope and resurrection of the dead, I am being judged. He said, you want to know what the problem is here? And I'm filling in some lines and, of course, paraphrasing. But he, in essence, is saying, Lysias over here, Claudius Lysias, this man Lysias has been wanting to know since the day he met me, what have I done that was wrong? And I'll tell you what the problem is. The thing that I've done that is wrong is I have been preaching Jesus being raised from the dead. And that's where the rub is. That is where the conflict is. That was the heart of his preaching, that Jesus was raised from the dead. If Jesus was raised from the dead, then he is the Son of God. They did not accept that. They did not believe that at all. If Jesus is raised from the dead, then you must accept him and follow him. They did not want to do that. If Jesus was raised from the dead, that brings consequences, and they don't like the consequences of what he had been teaching. And so they want to reject his teaching, and therefore they have to reject the man who taught that. Paul said, I want to tell you where the problem is. The council meeting is for the purpose of figuring out where the problem is. The problem is, I am teaching Jesus raised from the dead, and that's the heart of the matter. That's where it's all about. That's where the conflict is. And he hit the nail on the head. There was another conflict, though, and that is there was a conflict between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. If you think there's no humor in the Bible, then you need to start again and read again. Some writers talk about the use that Jesus made of humor in his teaching. One of the works I'm consulting and going through in teaching the teacher's class is a work where Brother King talks about the humor of Jesus in his teaching, and that's an interesting thing to look at. There's almost a sense of humor here, of the conflict that arose between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. Here are two groups that are opposed to each other and can't stand each other and almost hate each other. In fact, they do hate each other. They stand together against Paul. And it is most interesting that the council meeting, the Supreme Court among the Jews, has some Sadducees and the Pharisees together. And they're going to work together on this council, this Supreme Court among the Jews. And they're trying to stand together against Paul. Paul uses the difference between them to disrupt what would not have been a fair hearing anyway. He knows this is not going to be a fair trial. If this was going to be a fair trial where they come out and they declare him innocent and they declare he's teaching the truth and we all need to accept that, Paul would have stayed in the midst of the council and let it ride. But that's not what he did. Begin in verse 6 with me. When Paul perceived, when he looks around and realizes, I see some Pharisees here and I see some Sadducees. Maybe the way they were dressed, maybe the way some mannerism they had somehow, or maybe somebody informed. He perceived some of these people, of these 70-something people that are gathered together. Some of them are Pharisees, some of them are Sadducees. I detect that. Verse 6, he cried out to the council. This must have been bold and loud and clear. I want them to hear this. I do not want to mince my words. I want them to hear this clearly. What did you say, Paul? I am a Pharisee. The son of a Pharisee. And it's concerning the hope of the resurrection of the dead I'm being judged. Now, when he mentioned that, look at verse 7. There was dissension that arose. He knew that was going to happen. Paul had to smile when he saw this beginning to erupt. He knew that was about to happen. That is implied from verse 6. There was a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. And here's the reason. The Sadducees, I'm reading at verse 8, say there is no resurrection and no angel or spirit, but the Pharisees confess both. Well, they had real doctrinal differences, didn't they? Real doctrinal differences. Verse 9, there arose a loud outcry, and the scribes, who were of the Pharisees' party, arose and protested, saying, we find no evil with this man. For if a spirit or an angel had spoken to him, let us not fight against God. Now that's almost laughable, isn't it? But they would say that. You see, now they're divided and they're arguing among themselves rather than standing against Paul. Paul knew that was going to happen. All I have to do is mention I'm one of these Pharisees over here, and I believe what they believe about resurrection. That's what I'm preaching. And he knew that that would create an enmity between them. And now they are arguing between themselves rather than standing against Paul. Sometimes that happens accidentally. I had a discussion one time with some Jehovah's Witnesses, and they were at the door, and I was in a meeting in Indiana, and they came to the door, and I began to contend with them a little bit, and they began to have some trouble. So there was a superior outside whom they brought in, and I began to ask him the same questions, and he gave different answers than they did. And I merely pointed out that there was a difference between them, and then stood back and watched them argue among themselves. And that's how the discussion ended. They're still arguing when they went out the door of which one of them was right. And Paul recognized that's going on here. They're arguing among themselves. But I want you to notice this at verse 9. This is interesting. The Pharisees defend Paul. It sounds like it, verse 9. They stand up and said, he hasn't done any wrong. He hasn't sinned at all. We don't find any wrong with it. We're ready to dismiss this man because it just might be that an angel or a spirit has spoken to him. And if that's happened, then we might be fighting against God, and we don't want to do that. The truth of the matter is, these Pharisees don't care anything about themselves. That's the truth. They're not defending Paul. They don't care about defending Paul. All they care about is defending themselves. Be careful when somebody stands by your side. It might not be they're standing by your side. They may be defending themselves. And that was the case with these Pharisees. They're not standing with Paul at all, and Paul knows that. Paul knows that, absolutely. Let's talk about something else now and move on to verse 11. With that, I might suggest to you that that meeting was disrupted. Now that's most interesting because this is not where the Pharisees and the Sadducees thought this thing was going. They never thought that would end in that kind of disruption. Verse 11, there is a statement of comfort for this Paul, the prisoner. What was said at verse 11? The following night, after this big disruption at the council meeting, Paul had to walk away scratching his head and with a smile. of, wow, that didn't go like they thought, did it? Paul had to be wondering about some things, and so the Lord the following night said, "Be of good cheer, Paul. For as you have testified for me in Jerusalem, you must also bear witness at Rome." Well, what the Lord said was, "Be of good cheer." The New American Standard translates that, "Take courage." I like that rendering of that. It's not different in meaning, it's just a different way of expressing that. Be of good cheer, Paul. It's not just saying, "Be happy, Paul." But he's saying to Paul, "Take courage." No doubt Paul had every reason to be discouraged. He is uncertain about the future. There had to be some encouragement that this meeting disrupted like it did, and it didn't go quite like the Pharisees thought it would. They didn't hang him or anything. But he is still a prisoner, verse 18. What's going to happen to him? Paul had to be discouraged. He is uncertain about the future. Robertson observed, "Paul never needed Jesus more than now." You ever reach the point that you think, "There's never a time I need Jesus more than now"? And there's probably not a time where Paul needed him more than at this point. Robertson observes, and he is one of the ripest of the scholars, said that this word, "Be of good cheer," is a brave word, he said. He is telling him, "Be brave, Paul. Be courageous." And he promises him three things. He says to him at verse 11, "Here you are assured of three things. Number one, your life will be spared." He doesn't use that terminology. But if he's saying to him, at Jerusalem, "You're going to go to Rome," how is he going to do that unless his life is spared? So that's the conclusion Paul has to walk away with, is that the Lord has just told me that my life is going to be spared, and so they're not about to kill me right now. All right? What else are you telling me, Lord? "You're going to testify to me in Rome." Paul had wanted to go to Rome, but he didn't think he was going this way, but he does get to go, and the Lord says, "You're going to testify to me, of me in Rome." You're going to go to Rome, and you're going to be able to preach the gospel in Rome. As a prisoner, you're going to be able to do that. And how that happened, it did. Now, that was the fulfillment of a promise made in Acts 23. Now, no, Acts 26, rather, in verse 16. Let's go to Acts 26, 16. Acts 26 is an account of his conversion. And so even though it's later than Acts 23, it's talking about events that happened previous to this. So Acts 26, 16, what the Lord had said is that you'll be a witness to me both of the things that you have seen and of the things that I will yet reveal to you. The Lord said to him, when he appeared to him, said, "You're going to be a witness. And of the things that I've shown you now, that is my presence on the road to Damascus, but I'm going to show you things in the future that's going to take." Well, the Lord is fulfilling that. You're going to go to Rome. And therefore, he was comforted. Here's something else about Paul the prisoner. There was a conspiracy against Paul. It's called a conspiracy at verse 13. Verses 12 to 24, tell us about the conspiracy. Let's see what it was. The conspiracy involved 40 Jews who had taken an oath to kill Paul. Let's see what that's about, beginning at verse 12. "And when it was day," this is the day after he had had this appearance of the Lord, at verse 11, giving him the comfort. "When it was day, there were 40 Jews that band together," some Jews that band together, later identified as 40, "and they bound themselves together under an oath, saying they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul." They're not going to eat anything. They're not going to drink anything until they have killed Paul. Here's what I see from that. I see the degree of hatred for Paul and for the truth. Perhaps you have someone, a friend or a neighbor or a relative or someone that almost despises you for your stand for the truth, but I doubt they've made a plan to kill you. I doubt that's happened to you. It has not happened to me. But here is the degree of hatred they had for Paul. That when the truth was preached, they hated him to the point that they wanted to kill him. And it's hard for us, unless we've been in those circumstances, to understand that. There have been times when there have been controversy of major issues in the church in the 1800s, the 1950s, and the 1930s over premillennialism, etc. There were some of those kinds of controversies where things escalated to the point where brethren were fighting with one another, literally fighting with one another, and knives drawn. Robert Jackson, you've heard me tell, in Louisville, Kentucky, had a knife drawn on him in the dark. Someone shoved him in a room and pulled a knife on him because he taught the truth one night at Taylor Boulevard. That happened. And had Grover Stevens not been there and hollered, "Look out, Robert, he's got a knife," he would have been stabbed by one of his own brethren. Now, if you hadn't seen that kind of thing, you don't understand the nature, and I haven't seen it like those brethren did, then we don't understand the degree of hatred that comes sometimes for truth. But here was the plan they had. What was the plan? Well, this begins now at verse 13. They formed this conspiracy, and the plan was this. They're not going to eat or drink until they've killed him. Now, that's quite a vow. They worked, according to verse 14, with the chief priest and the elders, and then they went on to the council, and they are all in cahoots with one another. And they all agree, this is okay, we'll do this. That shows you the character of the people that made up the council, and the chief priest and the elders. And what they said is, we want the council to make out like they want to hear more of Paul, and so what you do is you give him to come back, and in the journey from the prison over to the council meeting, we're going to ambush him and we're going to kill him. So y'all call for him and act like you want to hear more questions from him. You'll never see him because we're going to ambush him. And we're going to kill him along the way. Now, that sounds serious, doesn't it? We're not going to eat or drink. We'll not take another bite nor drink another drink until we've killed him. And on the surface reading, cursory reading of that, you'd think, I wonder, since they didn't do it, how many of them died from hunger. Well, the Jews had an exception to the rule that if they couldn't fulfill a vow, they were exempt from the vow. So that's quite strong to say, we won't eat a drink or take a bite or eat a drink until we've killed him. Well, we missed that. Let's go have a meal now. That's kind of the way they went about that. And that tells you something of the character of the people. They didn't fulfill their vow. What happened then? Well, beginning at verse 16, Paul's nephew spoiled the plot. This is the only time we read anything about Paul having a sister. Who was she? We don't know. This is only reference. And she had a son. Were there more children? I don't know. This is the only thing mentioned about Paul's family that we know anything about. And we don't know much about that. We know he had a sister. We know he had a nephew. Where did he get his information? How did he learn? We do not know. We're not told. But beginning at verse 16, Paul's nephew had heard about the plot, and he comes and tells Paul. At verse 16, the text says that when his sister's son heard of the ambush, he entered the barracks and he told Paul. Paul called the centurion and told